Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Hey, Pete.
Jake Gunkelman.
Myself kicked in here. I've got the wire to my Bose headset. Ended up with an intermittent in it, so I had to replace them. And these, I didn't know, because the word gaming is in it, they've got these.
You know exactly. Those are sweet.
Color. It's got a microphone, and it's all wireless, and yeah. It works. So,
you're a gamer. Ketamine, the Vatican.
Hey.
Anything strike your fancy there?
How many buttons do you want to push today? You did a good job of what you sent out. I don't know. Why don't we do Elmo and ketamine? That seems to match quite well with dancing puppets.
Well, this is what's going on around the world.
As the article said, it is the Wild West. It's an off-label use, and there's no standard of practice.
Yeah.
So you find the practitioner that you find, and it doesn't necessarily mean you know what you're looking for. Yeah. You know, you're looking for ketamine. Well, ketamine nasal, ketamine IV infusion. Are you talking about somebody who's just going to toss a blanket over you and let you be in a room? Or are you talking about somebody who's going to design a therapeutic session with what kind of music? What are the background concepts that we're going to kind of infuse your session with? Almost like a hypnotic script that can be applied, and those can have a fabulously powerful effect. The ketamine itself has a pharmacological effect, but in the right environment, it can end up being a more profound effect. And there also are contraindications. The study done by Ron Swatsina that looked at medication failure in psychiatry at a few thousand people, there were hundreds of them that had been referred specifically because other psychiatrists couldn't figure out their meds. So they were referred in for medication failure. We looked at the intake EEGs on them, did cluster analysis to look at the kinds of EEG patterns that were present in people that you couldn't medicate. epileptiform content was the number one finding. These are psych patients. This is not a neurology practice treating epilepsy. So when somebody comes in with epileptiform content, you don't know it's there, what are you going to give them? Probably something that's not going to help or make it worse, perhaps. You know, so medication failure, that predicts it. Beta spindles also, that was a number two, spindling excess beta, greater than 20 microvolts, and Niedermeyer declares that outside normal limits, and so would I. And that could predict negative medication response. You know, and after that it was a low voltage, slow EEG, which is a metabolic or toxic effect, and then focal findings, which is probably more of an organic lesion of some sort, not a psych patient. So the two at the beginning of that list, epileptiform content and beta spindles, also predict odd outcomes with ketamine. The probability of having the K-hole experience, and it probably is just as bad as it sounds.
I've been called that before, Jay. What is a K-hole?
well, it's a negative, a very negative psychiatric outcome for a ketamine session.
But they used to call a really bad trip.
yeah. And, you know, you're not jumping off roofs like old LSD lore.
But I mean, is that like, I've heard it in our clinic in the next office over, people moaning and all that type. Is that a K-hole or is it?
Not necessarily, okay. You know. Right. Yeah, there are like really loud expressions of emotion that can happen during it that are not part of necessarily a bad trip, but perhaps a breakthrough. So, but the overall experience being a very negative experience that leaves you off. But you know. Ketamine ends up having a dramatic increase in a high frequency up into the 20s in the cortex, but it's not in the same layer level as gamma is produced, but it's a similar high frequency wave, and it also dramatically increases slow activity temporarily. And if you have slow rhythmic activity frontally in the theta band in excess, you're more likely to end up having a dramatic positive experience with ketamine. It drives that theta way, way, way up during session, and it collapses it after the session is done. So what you come in with excess theta, it goes crazy high during the session, but it collapses afterwards, is normalized. And that theta at the frontal midline likely is a reward deficiency marker. So anyway, ketamine is still the Wild West. As buyer beware. It isn't like you can go on Psychology Today and flip through the list of providers. They don't try to stick out in regulatory realms.
Just jump in here, Jay, and you know, my greatest concern, and we really have to put this on the table, is who is seeking out ketamine treatment. Okay, curious, hey, I want to try this, I've heard it cool. But the majority of individuals are really, really some form of chronic depression, primarily. And, you know, it's an extremely vulnerable population. So in terms of like, how does somebody do their due diligence in this field, given that it is so wide west, I think we need to address that. And a lot of us really don't recommend it because of that, you know, and until we get that figured out, who's doing the good work and who's swinging from the hip, as they say.
Yeah. And Again, doing a good one-on-one interview with the practice to find out, again, are they simply going to toss a weighted blanket over you and let you ride it out, or are they going to be there trying to, guide the experience and select the music that, you've listed and so forth to try and guide the trip. So, there's a wide range of types of practice, and you need to upfront find out. You don't find out afterwards. Effectively, you need to interview them as to what the what their structure is. How many sessions? How much does it cost? $500, $600 a session. Are you doing six of them? Some people do. Are you doing 10? Some people do. Are you suggesting booster sessions every couple of weeks afterwards to keep the depression at bay? I mean, all of that ends up being stuff that you need to discuss up front, because it's a it's not pocket change,
I
so.
want to loop into another one, Pete, if you don't mind. I know we kind of were thinking of just talking about the ketamine, but I want to throw in ayahuasca. Jay, when you were talking about how you get this diffuse, slow activity, but it's temporary, one of the things I'm finding, and not knowing the full history of the client, it's been really interesting, that I've had not just a couple of people, quite a few people, that have been using ayahuasca therapeutically, and then have decided to follow up with neurotherapy. And the slow alpha universally throughout the brain, and we're talking months and months and months after. Any idea why that's sticking around? I mean, I know marijuana
It may have
has.
been a self-selection
Yeah.
for why they were going for the ayahuasca as well.
Yeah, no, pre it wasn't there. It
It
wasn't
may
there.
be a treatment effect, but
Yeah.
that's not the usual expected
Yeah.
effect. It may be something odd with what they were doing. But David Stuckey got his PhD going down to the Amazon with an old Lexichor, and having a generator in the village, running extension cords out into the jungle where the shamans were doing their ceremonies. And when he got back, Frank Eichenhofer was his dissertation chair. And Frank basically said, "Oh, it's all muscle artifact." And poor David, he had gone down to the freaking Amazon, carried this stuff out there, done all his hard work, and comes back, and he's basically told, "Well, all the stuff you collected is crap, So, yep, got to get a whole different PhD now, But he saw that I had written this book about EEG artifacts, so he came to me with the data. He says, "Just tell me this is crap. I'll leave you alone. I'm sorry. I'm not worthy even to be here to show you this. The groveling to try and get me to see the data." And of course, that's the only silly question I ever get is, "Jay, would you like to look at this data?" Of course, I looked at the data, and he says, "It's all muscle." And I said, "No, it's not. This is the highest hypersynchronous gamma I've seen since the Dalai Lama's monks at Davidson's lab. So this is gamma. This is not muscle. Now, there's muscle in some spots, but you can see hypercoherence, and then you see the EMG areas are not part of that coherence. So, yeah, it's fast activity, but it's not all muscle." And so he said, "Well, Frank says it's all muscle." I said, "Well, tell him to look at the coherence and explain how you get hypercoherent muscle. You cannot synchronize the muscle spikes. This it's not going to happen. So synchronizing all these muscle spikes across the brain, forget it. But gamma is a rhythm, and it can be synchronized. So the temporal areas with muscle weren't coherent, but the rest of the brain was hypercoherent. And he had to argue that with Frank. And after he told Frank that I told him to argue that. Frank said, okay. And he got his PhD off of that. But it's a very, very, very strong gamma effect on a fairly acute level. But it does end up having, I don't know if anybody in the crowd here has done LSD, but after the LSD trip, you have kind of a burnout feeling for a while. And after the ayahuasca, there can be a kind of a burnout feeling, and that ends up having slow content associated with it. So it may be that your few people that you've seen have residual slowed alpha, which is a decreased arousal level. It's actually more,
if you were, you know, doing this for anxiety, would actually be a positive effect. So, you know.
and it's more internal than external in orientation. You know, the IE scale, Les Femi was great for having wonderful data about alpha and other neuropsychological functions. And the IE scale, internal orientation versus external orientation, was proportional to the alpha frequency tuning. So, you know, if you got really fast alpha, you're probably not really closely in touch with your internal states as much as if you have slower alpha.
Elmo.
Oh, poor Elmo. Yeah. You know,
poor California. Sorry, Jay.
You know, if you go to some places on the internet and you ask people, gee, how are you today? You're going to get a response. Now, where you ask it may get you a different kind of response depending upon where you ask it. If the place you ask it is full of conspiracy folks, you may get a whole different how are you today than if you go to a yoga camp and ask it or something. So when you go to X, they know what the response is. It kind of freaked them out. It's people having bummer. And but again, I think there's a self-selection to a certain extent that has a bias. If nothing else, it's absolutely full of people that try to follow what's on X in order to put it on the news. So there's a lot of reporters on there. So.
But it's Elmo.
But on the other, I'm going to jump in with a totally different side. Like, I mean, you look at like one of these extreme talents of good old fashioned Sesame Street, you know, granted the kids were so young they couldn't tell fantasy from reality, but all of those puppets were just brilliant at putting their little fuzzy rotted arms around kids and saying, how you doing? And the kids would really talk, you know, that show was known for that. So, even, you know, if in therapy, good old fashioned, you know, talk to the puppet and you'd hear different things. But, you know, apart from that, one thing I think we really, really have to acknowledge is we're in I would say, an epidemic of loneliness now, almost globally, anxiety, just lack of belonging, you know, and I think this is reflecting it. I think we need to talk about all of this. Everybody is talking about a mental health crisis. I think we're in a cultural crisis, and the effect is poor mental health. You know, sure, a little bit too much publicity for the wrong people, perhaps, but if it starts a dialogue, all right. You know, and if we, again, I keep on looping back, the only educational program, actually, no. Mr. Rogers was pretty good too, but you know, Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers really, really started to look at the emotional content, you know, really cater to positive emotional exploration in little people.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
And if they can help out the big people, why not? But yeah, too much money involved, Jay.
And your icon from your childhood is asking you how you are.
Exactly.
So.
Hey, there's
my co-host here is bringing me things to fill with treats, but it's not that time for me here, so I'll send him on his way chasing the Kong.
Well, part of that article, and I'll include it in here so the viewers and listeners can see what we're talking about. You got Elmo going around asking how you feeling, and then of course everybody's saying I feel crappy. And then they go into the homeless and the mental health crisis in California, and there's a bill introduced that may be passed. I guess that'd be a good thing, Dre. More money for mental health. That's the way I run it. Bad for you. I mean, I don't know how you guys can get taxed anymore in California, but if they do increase the budget, how will they spend it, you think?
Poorly. government programs have a way of creating positions and overhead in a way as opposed to getting a lot of direct services. There are a lot of programs for the homeless, but the homeless aren't necessarily all that well served. There are locations that are intervening fairly aggressively. Taking hotels that aren't well used at this point and getting government grants for $10, $20 million to totally redo the hotel into small residential units and have some office space in there for people that help the homeless folks for social services and so forth. So ground level offices and housing. There are people that are aggressively intervening, but there's also locations where they're trying to essentially outlaw loitering. Right now in California, unless you can offer them an alternative location, you can't necessarily just shoo them off of property easily. And government can't shoo them off of private property. The private property people have to be there to end up having them declare trespassers and have them removed at that point. So it's a very difficult issue, and it shows that the economy has not been rolling well for the last 4 or 5 years, as you saw the number of homeless just skyrocket.
Yeah, it's funny. This is always so delicate, but my primary comment is, I think many of us, and in particular politicians, make some extreme assumptions on the causes of homelessness. It is so varied. I actually, volunteered for quite a long time in, Vancouver downtown east side, which is the worst neighborhood in Canada. You want to see homelessness, I'll show you homelessness. And one of the things that was very, very interesting is we go housing, 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 but the quote unquote rules of the housing, people actually felt safer on the street. you know, from whether they couldn't take in their belongings, which, you know, the people working for the supposedly for the homeless, you know, said was valueless, but that was all the person possessed. So some of the crises of not being able to keep your things. Some, you know, they know the rules of the street. They feel safer on the street. And that's just one example. But if I ruled the world, I'd say, go low. You want to help people, you know, in adolescence, in, you know, it should be an issue addressed in education, much lower, in safety and families, supporting young families. You know, homelessness is very much an end symptom. So there's my political rant.
Oh, yeah. I got one for you.
Yep.
We're talking about homelessness. Are migrants homeless? Because I'm in Illinois, we have Texas shipping people over and dropping them off in Illinois and in Chicago, and the Chicago mayor is buying them a train ticket and saying, hey, go to a suburb of your choice, and they're getting dropped off. You know, and there's
political
no
political games again. I mean, you know, these are people. Right. I mean, and what you just spoke about an entirely different population. How do we expect to deal with these populations or manage or assist these populations in the same way? I mean,
homeless. So if you have, you know, these people coming in, you know, eventually the emergency room is going to get flooded and ER can't handle mental health. Right. Mm-hmm. So then where does it go?
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, one of the things, you know, it probably speaks to the population that I work with, but if you help an adolescent in whatever emotional crisis they happen to be in, so they don't leave home, they don't go on the streets, they finish high school, they don't discover those nasty drugs, right? I mean, that's a huge portion. And then, of course, we're talking about purely economic homelessness. You know, the classic people living in their cars because they can't pay their mortgage. But correct me if I'm wrong. There's not as much of that as I would say the mental health issue. Jay, would you?
The number of people that are living paycheck to paycheck. And all it takes is one significant health upset.
Yep.
You know, you had COVID and you were in the ICU for 2 months, and now you're not really well, but you're back out. You didn't have a job during that because you weren't working and you were fired, and now you're and you're homeless.
You owe 2 months rent. Yeah.
And you're homeless. If you want to see the causes of bankruptcy, look at the healthcare system.
Yeah.
You know, the diagnosis of cancer is the highest cause of bankruptcy.
Well, here, I mean, up in Canada, and, you know, we're not as good as we used to be. We're starting to really fail up here. But if you look at most of Europe, you don't have those issues.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be political. The U.S., one of the things the rest of the world just doesn't understand is why you don't take care of your people healthcare-wise.
Yeah. Well, we've got a bunch of states that just dropped their Medicaid, huge, you know, what's it, 29,000 people just lost their health care because of political choice. And it was being paid by the federal government if they allowed the program. And they just cut food aid for kids. So, you know, there's a lot of various political decisions that don't seem to make much humanistic sense, and that's always a shame.
Well, you could say you could pray, but then look at the Vatican article.
Oh, good segue, Pete. Woo-hoo. Yeah.
They're talking about suicide, so I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, institutions that are supposed to be caring, I'm glad they're doing things to care more. How's that? Yeah.
Politics, religion. What did we miss?
Well, politics, religion, healthcare, we're all in there. No, but I think it's time that, you know, every institution has to pull up its socks a little bit and practice what they preach, no pun intended, And it wasn't too long ago that your priest was your mental health practitioner. You know, your priest was your everybody. But I also really respect that they're looking at boundaries as well. You know, pastoral counseling has a place, but it also definitely doesn't have a place. We talked before about, you know, in terms of sexuality, there are just, you know, bounds there that after a certain point, you're just not qualified to help. I would say the same thing also with mental health. But my gosh, if you're there and you're on the floor and you're going to be present, and you know, to help people find paths to assist themselves, I'm all for it, right? I mean, the U.S. again is a very religious country.
And we've just finished like a 2-year period where everyone was isolated, and kids were missing the face-to-face contact with other kids. They weren't out playing. You know, the physical activities were curtailed, and what a weird experiment, you know. Suddenly we've got this crazy negative impact on pretty much the entire population, and the effect of that on mental health is not positive. I, you know, isolation is used as a form of torture, for goodness sakes. So here we are isolating kids from each other, and they find a weirder social contact online. And goodness knows the warnings about predators and whatnot that are online. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, the one thing that really concerns me is we never bounce back. You know, one would think that somebody in high school, you know, when they return to high school, the problem would be over, so to speak, right? Or finish high school and starting university. But the loneliness factor of youth. I mean, I understand 65-year-old widow lost, you know, their partner, et cetera, et cetera. You're going through a pretty long-term phase of loneliness, right? But it's universal now. It's really universal. But the catch is why. Why are people not getting out there again, right?
But you know, you can get a chat companion nowadays. Oh, that AI companion that'll keep you happy and chatter with you. And of course, some of them have had to been shut down because they got a little out of control. So, you know, maybe that's not even a great idea, you know.
Don't worry, Jay. Elon Musk has Grok out there. I'm sure you use that. Speaking of Elon Musk, you want to touch that implant or?
I don't want to touch that implant. Let's be sure the explant that they took out of the monkeys, and there were 10 monkeys that were euthanized, and he said, well, they were old and sick. Well, they weren't old and sick, or they wouldn't have been there for the research. But so there's these 10 dead monkeys that had implants that ended up causing them to be euthanized. But when they explanted the implants, the Mac monkey is universally contaminated with hepatitis B. So you have a hepatitis B device, and you have to ship that in appropriate, I mean, there's standards for medical waste. You can't toss it into a FedEx pack and ship it. You know, and that's what they did. And UC Davis severed their relationship with them entirely because of how sloppy and careless they were. And you know, you can't have that and have a primate lab. You can't have people killing off 10 of your primates. So, now they have one person. Now there have been people that have volunteered, and they have one person that they just had their. Have you seen their device, Pete? You can probably put up an image of it. It looks like a weird microscope and a sewing machine all kind of whipped together. And they drill a hole in your skull, pop through the dura, and then this little sewing machine sticks these threads with 1,024 electrodes on them. They stick these threads into the brain tissue. And, you know, I think that's kind of invasive. Last I knew, sticking things into your brain can end up being problematic. Things like bleeding, you know. So the person is apparently recovering, but they're going to put the device in after he kind of recovers from the implant itself. You know, there are people that are much more advanced in the brain-computer interface world than Elon Musk's group is at this point, that put in stents through the vasculature. They'll weave through the vasculature and stick in a stent that opens up a blood vessel, like they do to open up a heart blood vessel. That's now an electrode. So they, and it's not just an electrode, that little stent's got a whole bunch of electrodes. And there are other people that are designing nanoparticles that are little amplifiers, and you can inject them and they float up and embed somewhere up in the brain, but they're really, really small. So it's not like you're clogging much. So, but then you can turn them on with ultrasound and then they amplify. So you can measure a brain activity with nanobot amplifiers. So there, you don't necessarily have to have a hole drilled in your head and have destructively implanted wires placed to have brain computer interface.
Niels Birbaumer, scientist, right? You know, say like stick with the cars, but he actually didn't invent that car. He just banked it. A lot of people forget that.
Our field of neurofeedback is the home base for the development of brain-computer interface. BCIA spun off out of neurofeedback. And most of the implants that have been done have had to do some feedback training in order to get them fully functional. And it goes back a long ways. Niels Birbaumer did ALS spell, you know, ability to pick a letter on a screen and have it typed, type up words and sentences, select a pre-selected sentence, speech vocalizing, all of that was done from outside the skull with surface EEG electrodes. You know, now they're trying to get a little more fancy. By being in there, you can have higher density, more control surfaces can be controlled. So they're hoping to be able to take people that have ALS and cannot move, cannot even blink to say yes or no, and have their brain operate computers, environmental controls, things such as that. Again, it's a major attempt at rehabilitation for spinal issues and for ALS. You can get the person stuck into a robotic skeleton suit and have them walk. They can actually reach out and grab stuff with robotic assist on their own arms.
The work, and you know, we don't want to knock it. Obviously, the work is magnificent, but you know, caution. Build on the science that is already there. As you said, there are many, many safer ways to do things than just have somebody's head open and throw a sewing machine in. So,
you know, Elon Musk himself said, oh, there are other ways than having to go through the skull. You could come up through the blood vessels. Well, that's what the other groups are doing. So, you know, I think the invasive method is down the list a little ways from what would be chosen if you had your druthers, infection risk and whatnot. I mean, having a hole drilled in your head, yeah, I've had brain surgery. I recommend it highly if you really need it, but geez, don't do it casually, you know.
What are you doing this Tuesday afternoon?
Yeah.
Jay Gunkelman and Dr. Marie Swingle, thank you.
Fun chat, fellas.
Let's see if we get. Let's see how
kick
YouTube
off another Thursday morning here.
Huh? Elmo's depressed. I'll talk to you all later.
Poor Elmo.
Poor Elmo. Bye, guys.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration into polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.